Before we start discussing your work, can you tell us what your initial reaction was when you heard you'd be receiving the Roy Chapman Andrews Society Award?
Huge surprise. Flattered. It's a wonderful thing. There's a real history here in this award and its namesake, and so it's just great to be recognized for this, and I'm very happy.
How did you initially get involved in climate studies? In particular, what led from geology to glaciology?
My interest goes back to high school and before. I liked to go hiking. I liked to crawl through caves. I collected rocks. I had a lapidary set up, and so I went into geology at Ohio State. And there were two jobs open for summer work, and I was looking for summer work. One was cleaning fossils with a dental pick, and the other was working for the glaciologist. And I took the glaciologist, a fellow named Ian Willens. That's a lot of years ago, and I'm still doing it. He had me looking for the fallout from atomic bombs in the snow as a way to figure out the snow accumulation rate. We didn't know how much snow in Antarctica. And the U.S. blew up some big bombs in the atmosphere, and they put markers in the snow. The Russians did too. And if you can find those markers and you measure how much snow was on top, that tells you the snow accumulation rate. So something good came out of that. And that, I'm still doing it in some sense.
Particularly with the bomb research, were you looking for decay products like strontium-90, or how did you do that research?
It was cesium-137 and strontium-90. You nailed it right off.
Figured as much. And were there any particularly surprising conclusions with that initial research?
Well, that initial research was just sort of, let's find how much it snowed. And that's one of these big pieces. Ultimately, yeah, so we study ice for a few reasons. It's fascinating. It makes these gloriously beautiful landscapes. But the big issues for studying the big ice are, one, what is the history of climate written in it? And two, will it fall in the ocean and flood the coasts? And knowing how much it snows is important in getting the balance of the ice. Is it growing? Is it shrinking? What is it doing for sea level? And so it's one little piece of one of these very big stories that eventually matter to people.
How did you make the jump from that to drilling into ice cores?
Right. So I needed a senior thesis, and Dr. Willens had gotten a 100-meter core from a place called Dome C up in East Antarctica. And so I did the geology of that for my bachelor's thesis. And, you know, how big are the crystals? How are they put together? What is the layering? And when I did my PhD, I started in on the geology again of the ice. And in particular, we were interested in the process by which snow turns to ice in a place where it is too cold to ever melt, even in the middle of the summer. And so there's grains, and then more grains fall on top, and more and more and more, these snowflakes, and the weight builds up, and it squeezes what's underneath it to ice. And the physics are akin to a number of things that are used in industry, powder metallurgy and ceramics. And so I was doing geology to help understand physics, to help understand engineering useful processes. And I went to Greenland, and I went to Antarctica, and in the course of watching the snow turn to ice, I gained a better ability to identify the annual layers in the snow and ice, because summer snow and winter snow really look different because the sun shines on it in summer and it doesn't shine on it in winter, and even if it doesn't melt, it changes. And once you've got summer, winter, when we drilled the deep core, I counted and counted and counted and worked with some other people who counted, and we counted 100,000 annual layers. And if you know how thick the annual layer is, you have a history of snowfall. And if you have a history of snowfall and you know how dirty the snow is, you know what was blowing around in the air from volcanoes and micrometeorites and dust and pollen, and all of a sudden you're a climate scientist.
Can you tell me about that moment when you were looking at your data and you made that transition into work about climate change?
Right. So one of the things that one learns when you do the history of climate is that climate has always changed. And the first thing that follows from that is climate is changeable, right? If climate never changed, we wouldn't worry about climate change, but climate has always changed. And that in turn means that it can indeed be changed, so we should think about it for the future. We often learn about climate change in part from what it does to living things. So I personally haven't done it, but some of my colleagues watch the changes in methane in the atmosphere, which was coming mostly from microbes living in wetlands. They watch changes in the isotopes of the oxygen itself, which is linked to who is living where on the Earth. And every time the climate changed, life changed. And they say, oh, okay, so climate has always changed. Climate has always affected living things in really fundamental ways. And then you put together this big story to which we contribute and a lot of other people contribute. Many things affect the climate. If you brighten the sun, it gets warmer. But the sun doesn't change very much. And if you put up a big volcano, it blocks the sun and it gets colder. But that only lasts a year or two. And when you work through all the causes of climate change in the past, what comes out is that carbon dioxide has been the most important control. And now we're at the point of climate is changeable. Carbon dioxide has been the most important control. Changing climate affects living things. We humans are changing carbon dioxide a lot. This is something we'd better understand.
How did you take that research to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Right. So I got involved mostly through the ice sheets. But as you know, and I believe your listeners will know, no one individual speaks for science. A scientist may say something brilliant, and a scientist may say something stupid. They may be political, they may not be political, but no one person speaks for science. Science is a communal thing, and once we scientists have done what we do and we get to the point of having a pretty good understanding, we've checked things lots of different ways, we've made as sure as we can that it works, then governments have worked out ways to sort of raise the lid on science, reach in and grab out the good parts, and let us go back to doing science and let them use that to make policy. And in the United States, this is often done through the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, the National Academies of Medicine. And they were founded by Lincoln. The House, the Senate, and Lincoln founded, you know, signed these back in during the Civil War, and they provide advice to the government, and you might call it assessment. What do we know which is solid? What's speculative? What's just silly? And so the United States for a long time has called the National Academies and said, what's going on in the National Academies? Tell them. The world for climate built a similar mechanism, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And this is to get the scientists of the world together to tell the world what we know. And it is, somebody once called it the mother of all committees, but it is just this huge number of scientists, mostly volunteering their time, to try to tell people what is out there. And I've had the interesting experience, the good fortune, to contribute at some level to three of their reports. The reports are sort of 5 or 6 years apart, and especially to the 2007 one, which happened to be the time when the committee won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Particularly since you said it's the mother of all committees, was there any difficulty in working with your data set, working as a scientist to try and get that information out, while dealing with governments and individual political things, either when it came to dealing with the statements or just how they interpreted the data?
Right. So the scientists are in charge of what goes in. And we, you know, you get down and say, okay, so what do we know? What have we learned since the last report? What can we write up? How can we make this as useful as possible? Then you open it to this huge group of people, scientists and then later others, who comment on it and make an immense number of review comments. And we address every single one of those review comments in a document which is public. And you go round and round and round. But eventually, it goes back to the policymakers, because they can require that we be clear and useful. And so when you get to the last piece of the writing, you have these representatives of all sorts of governments who are there, who are trying very hard to get the words to be as useful as possible. And then we have this team of scientists who are saying it must be true to the science. And that goes till 2 in the morning. And then you start over the next day and you do it over again, because the tension of making words useful while making them true to the science. How can we be clearer? Wait, no, that cuts a corner on the science. You can't say that, but it's not clear enough, but you're cutting a corner on the science. That is this fascinating tension that the week is completely, totally, and utterly exhausting. But when it's done, I think it works. I really think it would be hard to tweak it in ways that would do a notably better job.
How would you say people have taken that data now that climate change is a nationwide and worldwide issue?
Yeah, in some ways, you know, virtually every nation in the world now is signed on to a plan to try to do something about the global warming from fossil fuel CO2. And that really does live on the scholarship that's put together by the IPCC. So in that sense, it has had a large influence. We're not very close yet to the path that would do the most good economically based on the scholarship that's available. So we put together science. This is science. And then people turn that into impacts. More CO2 has some good. It has some bad. You trade off plant fertilization against ocean acidification. Really cold places might like it warmer. Really hot places really, really don't want it warmer. And so then you get to, given all this information, what can we do about it? And the economists have built these tools that sort of asks, we have some money, we can take care of ourselves now with it by consuming, we can invest in the broad economy, we can invest in heading off climate change. What is the path among those choices that does the most good economically for the most people? And so far, the answer is that we would be doing more to slow down global warming than we are now if we wanted to be efficient for the economy. If you want a big economy, you want a lot of jobs, you want to help people now and in the future. The economic studies keep saying over and over, you do more now, you don't panic. You still consume, you still invest in the broad economy, but you do more now to try to head off warming than we've gotten to yet. So the governments are moving, they're listening to what the IPCC said, but they have not yet gotten to that point of doing the most good for the most people, according to the scholarship.
Could you elaborate more on these measures that the scholarship says would do the most good?
Right. So the IPCC never is policy prescriptive. They never say, you must do this. This is your way forward. The national academies never do either. Across the economic community, what you'll find is a very strong preference for what they would call price signals. If we buy fossil fuel, we pay for the good we get from it, but society pays for the bad that comes from it. And so if you're causing climate change, people now and in the future will have to have some losses because of that climate change. And those of us who use the fossil fuel just get the good, and then all society pays for the bad. And so one can respond to something like that in many ways. We could outlaw it. We could just pass laws. We could have regulations. Economists love price signals. They say just put a tax on the carbon that is equal to the damages to society. And then people can make a decision. Do we want to use carbon and pay that tax, or do we want to do something else? And then the economists typically say, use that tax to get rid of some other tax, which is even worse for the economy. And I think the most common economic argument is tax carbon, not paychecks. And if you reduce the tax on wages and move that tax over to carbon, broadly, that gives you a lot better economy in the future. The cost of the carbon tax to the economy is similar to the cost of the wage tax to the economy. the carbon tax gets rid of the climate change or reduces it. And so the economy ends up bigger and better off if you take a path like that. There's lots of variants. There's cap and trade and fee and dividend. There are people who would prefer regulation. There are people who would like to outlaw things. But I believe that if you were to poll the serious economists about this, they would say put a price on carbon in some revenue neutral sense, use that money to get rid of some other economy distorting tax. And you will end up with a bigger economy and more jobs in the future.
Going back to the climate change itself, particularly with the kind of data that you're looking at the macro level, a lot of that is, again, the global implications and just you're looking at how the global rise in temperature, the increase in carbon dioxide affects the planet as a whole. How do you tell people basically at a regional level what is going to be affected in their climate by the increase in CO2? Or is it even possible to be that specific with your predictions?
Right. So I mean, you're asking the really good questions, Chase. You're good at this. There are pieces that one can do fairly clearly. So warmer temperatures give more heat waves and fewer cold snaps for almost everyone. When it rains, warmer air has more water in it, so it can rain more intensely. When it quits raining, it can dry out faster. So there are certain pieces that are pretty easy, and you can tell people that's what you're going to get. Expand, so more floods, more droughts, more heat waves, fewer cold snaps. Expansion of the subtropical dry zones seems fairly clear, and so some of that we get. A lot of the, if you then take that and say, what will be the difference upwind and downwind of, you know, Lake Michigan? We may not be very good at that yet. And so sort of how the region will differ from the adjacent region is pretty hard. And whether we're going to get that right for a while, I don't know. I'm not sure we're really good at that yet. And a lot of it still sort of hinges on decisions we make. Warming in your part of the world in midsummer has probably been a little smaller than you'd expect because people are growing so much corn and it evaporates so right, transpires so rapidly that has a little bit of a cooling effect. And so decisions we make on how much corn we grow versus oats actually might matter a little bit locally to you.
But from an observational perspective, are you saying that we simply don't have the data and the tools to be able to get that precise with our measurements?
It is still a question that the climate modeling world is working on, whether to what extent can we regionalize the global part. A lot of it is going to depend on the details of how El Nino and La Nina respond to the warming, and that's not quite as well understood as one might like. So I don't think, beyond the sort of warmer does these things, I don't think we're really good at telling yet how many polar vortex outbreaks you're going to have and whether the fronts are going to track just a little east of you or a little west of you compared to what you've had in the past. We're probably not very good at that yet.
I think this is a good transition to ask about what the RCA Society describes as your role of science communicator. Can you tell me how you've reached out to the public through books, speeches, and other direct engagement?
Yeah, so I've had this wonderful opportunity. I showed up at Penn State as a very new faculty member, and they threw me into big general education class. And I was fortunate in having good mentors who sort of helped me figure out how to explain things to a general education class. And that works pretty well with most people. And for whatever reason, I enjoy doing this, and despite sort of sounding funny, I seem to have some facility at helping people understand that which they want to understand. And so I keep teaching, and I sort of like teaching. And so I've written a few books, and I've testified to Congress a few times, and I give... Yeah, last few years it's been more than a talk a week. So, and I got to make a PBS TV miniseries and a few other things. So it's just all fascinating. But it's basically, I find a whole lot of people really do want to know, they're interested. And I find that ultimately using this knowledge will make us better off. Pretending that I'm a liar, pretending that science is a liar, is going to end up with a smaller economy, not a bigger one. It's going to end up with less national security, not more. It's going to, and so if you want to do the economically beneficial thing, it's actually in the same direction as the environmentally beneficial thing or the ethically beneficial thing right now. And there's this wonderful story of we can use knowledge to help ourselves. And I don't think that's been told as loudly and as well as it should be, and I'm doing my little bit to try to tell that.
Since you brought that up as well, how do you deal with denialists?
I hope to... Sometimes it's difficult. There are certain venues that deep discussion of the issues is just not possible. But my experience is that usually people actually do want better. They actually do want to help. That the folks that you might call denialists ultimately are very interested in moving the country forward. But they've sort of fallen into a hole where they think that dealing with this will make us worse off. It will do bad things. And that's really where the issue lies, is if one can run back and say, no, actually, if you are worried about the economy, this is a way forward. Dealing with this in a wise way can help the economy if we are efficient about it. If they're worried about jobs, the scholarship is actually clear that if we take efficient, wise actions to deal with the twin problems of energy and environment, we get more jobs, not fewer.
I know you're a scientist and not a prescriber of public policy, but one thing I believe a lot of people think when they come out of a lecture or watch something like Al Gore's The Inconvenient Truth is, there are all these big groups dealing with climate change, but what can I do?
Yeah, so I mean, what I usually tell individuals, if they ask, is there are two pieces of the story for you as a person. One is the big picture thing. You vote, you talk to your neighbors, you are involved in your community, you take what you care about and make it broader. And the second one is you can't solve all the problems, but if you want to take action personally, pick something that you care about and do that. Because ultimately, if we get over the difficulties, we can have a better world as we get into a sustainable system. And if everybody picked something, I care about bike paths, I care about recycling, I care about whatever, if the people who care picked something and moved forward on that, I think we'd get there. So, but you can't solve all the problems yourself, and do not try to solve all the problems yourself, or you'll go crazy.
Finally, is there anything else you'd like to add about the stuff we've discussed, or any other work you might like to highlight?
I mean, I'll just go back again. First of all, I thank you and to thank your listeners. I think that the fact that you're chatting with me and you're doing it from Northern Illinois, and that's a fine school. I have some friends there, and it's a wonderful place. And so using our knowledge will make us better off. And that may be the most important thing. And it's not just on global warming. It is across the board. We are well off because we have learned and we have taught and we have built. We've learned to get along with each other. That is so powerful. And what you're doing there at Northern Illinois and what the students and the professors and everyone are doing is feeding the world. It is keeping us healed from disease. It is giving us cell phones. It is, you know, using our knowledge can make us better off.
That was Dr. Richard Alley. He's the Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences and an associate of the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute at Penn State University. He is also the recipient of this year's Distinguished Explorers Award from the Roy Chapman Andrews Society in Beloit. I'm Chase Cavanaugh, and thank you for listening.